Welcome back to Franklin Covey's twice weekly podcast on leadership with Scott Miller. I'm your host, where each Tuesday and Friday, I have the privilege of sitting in this chair for, 6 years, nearly 400 episodes, where we shine Franklin Covey's spotlight onto entrepreneurs, onto creators, best-selling authors, business titans, leaders, researchers, sometimes people that have suffered some unspeakable tragedy and have learned to share a lesson of resilience with our guest, all designed to help make you a better leader, whether you define leader as a entrepreneur, solopreneur, intrapreneur, perhaps you are a leader of an organization in a formal or informal capacity, or maybe you are leading just your life, your business, your family. This podcast is here to make you a more effective leader. Today's guest is Dave Leninger. He is the chairman of RE/MAX, the co-founder of the RE/MAX real estate organization. His newest book is called The Perfect 10, 10 Leadership Principles to Achieve True Independence, Extreme Wealth, and Huge Success. Dave Leninger, welcome to On Leadership.
Well, thank you, Scott. Nice to be here.
Great to have you here. Dave, tell us where you're joining us from today.
We're from Denver, Colorado.
Dave, it's great to have you here. I've had the privilege of reading your book and have digested these principles for a couple of weeks now. Your book just released in the last 2 weeks and was a number one bestseller new release on Amazon. Not your first book. You are a New York Times bestselling author from previous books that you've authored. I wonder, before we get into the meat of The Perfect 10, would you rewind a couple of decades and maybe tell the RE/MAX story? Because when you tell that story, you tell your own story with your co-founder, your wife, Gail. Remind this audience what RE/MAX has become and how that has really fulfilled the vision of what you and your wife had about really kind of redesigning the real estate industry.
Well, when we founded the company in 1973, real estate agents were paid commissions by the owner of the office, generally speaking, on a 50-50 split. The agent kept their half for their income and to pay the things that they didn't get from the company, such as Social Security, health insurance, their own automobile, et cetera. The company kept its half to pay the overhead, marketing, secretarial assistance, rent, and try to make a profit. What RE/MAX did was significantly different. We decided we would form a real estate office, much like a co-op of doctors, lawyers, attorneys, accountants, whatever, that would share the expenses of running the business, but keep the vast majority of the funds for themselves. That was quite controversial. The brokers of the era were very upset with it because if it succeeded, they would have to change their conventional commission split. And so it was difficult to get started. We got through the challenges. I learned an awful lot. And 50 years later, we're in 110 countries, 9,000 offices, and about 150,000 or so sales associates.
Dave, I would be remiss if I didn't ask you the question to opine on what's currently happening, because you, of course, have been instrumental in shepherding as the chairman RE/MAX through, you know, the recent judgment and legislation, if you will, if it's legislation or it's more like a legal opinion. Without getting into the nuances, I'm sure everybody has an opinion or a question about what is the future of perhaps maybe residential real estate look like with the uncertainty ahead around the new reality. Maybe spend a minute on re-educating people what has happened recently. Talk about what you think the future will look like, and we'll dive right into the book.
Yes, there were several class action lawsuits filed starting 6 years ago that disagreed with the seller and the seller's commission paying the buyer agent's commission. The system had been set up over a period of time. The attitude of the Association of Realtors was that many first-time buyers don't have the money to pay a commission to have representation. And yet, if the seller paid the commission in some pro rata form, it was really being wrapped up in the purchase price and the mortgage of the agent or of the customer. We looked at it. We felt that there was no valid point to be made. But when we watched 6 years of litigation moving forward, we realized it was going to be an unending stream. The first case was coming up in Kansas City a couple months ago, and we had an opportunity to opt out and pay a fee to the plaintiff's attorneys to settle all the claims. We did so, as did Realogy. Several other companies did not. It went to trial. The trial was short. The jury found for the plaintiffs. And then, of course, the day that the jury came in, the national plaintiffs filed additional lawsuits against another 10 large companies. And then the copycat suits started following along as it was. So even though we felt that we did not have any liability, we felt that the unending series of litigations would certainly affect our profitability and our agents' ability to do business. So sometimes it's better to swallow the frog and just say, I don't think we're wrong, but if I can get out of this and move forward with my business and my agents can, that's what we did. It was a universal settlement, and so it solved all the claims at that time and in the future with any other attorneys that got involved. And so it was a wise decision.
Sounds like you and your associates at RE/MAX will be on the right side of history on that one from a variety of perspectives. Dave, last question on this. So say someone's going to be buying a home in July or in August. How does it change the buyer-seller go-forward strategy? As someone like me who, you know, buys a new home or buys a home every 4 or 5 years for my family, how does it change my life?
One of the agreements and the settlements that the judge put forward was more transparency, that if you have a buyer agent, the buyer agent must have a signed agreement with the buyer, not just a verbal, I'll get my commission from the seller. The second thing is the MLSs cannot advertise what the co-oping commission would be if the seller was willing to pay part of it. That way you can't cherry pick properties as a buyer agent stating, well, this seller won't pay anything, but the seller two blocks away would pay maybe 2.5%. And so that stops that from happening. It does not stop at this point the seller from making concessions and thinking that, hey, I need to get my property sold and I understand the situation and I'm willing to pay for that. Short term, everybody's scrambling, trying to figure out what are these agreements? How do we sign them? How do we sell this to the general public? Long term, I think the long term, response will be, I think NAR will lose a lot of its membership. Consumer Federation of America did a study on residential real estate a few months back. And in it, they discovered 50% of the realtors in NAR had not had a closing in 12 months. As you know, there are a lot of beginners, a tremendous number of part-timers, and maybe do one deal a year every other year. At this point, it's going to make it much more difficult for people like that to stay in the business. And so I think eventually it will help professionalize the business and get it more into a true profession. Right now, there's just no barriers to entry.
Dave, thank you for placating me and answering some of those questions, because no one can speak to it more eloquently and honestly than you could. I know you enough to say that. Your book is The Perfect 10 Leadership Principles to Achieve True Independence, Extreme Wealth, and Huge Success. Dave, you have expertise on a broad variety of areas in business: leadership, culture, sales, entrepreneurship, franchising. I want to ask you a question or two on each of those. As the chairman of RE/MAX, now that you are in sort of the crescendo of your life with kids and grandkids and your wife and looking at taking your business expertise in a variety of areas, you've emerged as one of the nation's, if not world's, experts on the power of franchising. You yourself own several franchise organizations. Would love to have you maybe teach a couple of lessons for those individuals who are interested in either building wealth or taking their business acumen and applying it in a franchise world. What are some things that people need to know about? Kind of like caveat emptor when it comes to being involved in a franchise. You write about it, it's a chapter in the book, and maybe first introduce what the different types of franchises that you're currently involved in.
I'm involved in a mortgage franchise called Motto. It's a subsidiary now of REMAX, obviously heavily involved with REMAX. We also own two sandwich companies. One is called Port of Subs. They're based regionally out of Las Vegas, Reno, and the Northwest. The other one is Daddy's Chicken Shack, and it's a new quick service business of sandwiches. Both of them are awesome products. We got involved with it, bought both companies, and have brought our expertise on franchising, the FDD documents, legalities, trademarks, marketing, franchise sales. And we're very excited about it. Franchising has got a tremendous opportunity for the franchisee if they get the right franchise.
Dave, for someone who's interested in buying into a franchise, are there some common mistakes people make? As in, you know, put the product aside for a second. Let's just say that, you know, the viability of the business is there. What are some of the common mistakes or ignorances that people have when their franchise goes south, their individual franchise goes south? What are some of the things people need to be aware of?
Well, I think the most important aspect is that in the United States, there are about 1,400 franchisors that belong to the International Franchise Association. However, there are 4,000 franchisors in the United States. 400 new franchisors are added every year. The failure rate of those new franchisors is significantly high. People have often been told if you buy a franchise, it's a much higher likelihood of being very successful. That's actually too general of a statement. If you buy the right franchise, for instance, if you buy a McDonald's franchise, they're going to vet you extremely well. You're going to have financial resources to do that. And having a McDonald's fail is almost unheard of. They've got the market share, they got the advertising, they got the systems, the technology, the training, and so it's a cookie cutter. Same thing with Chick-fil-A. Chick-fil-A is one of the most successful franchisors out there. They have almost the same benefits that McDonald's does. So if you look at franchisors, all great franchisors at some method address four aspects of the entrepreneur. Number one, they have a unique product or service. Number two, they have market share and advertising. Number three, they have training, systems, organizations. And four, they have group purchasing. And I don't care if that's a nail salon or if that's a hamburger joint. Those are the things that set franchisors apart. The biggest mistake that is made by somebody that starts looking around is everybody's got a good story. But if you buy into an early franchisor, there isn't much track record there. And so a lot of times they're going through learning in the startup as much as the new franchisee is. So you just have to be really careful to think your way through it, read every sentence of the FDD, and get all of your questions answered. The likelihood of succeeding goes up with the size of the existing franchisor.
Dave, you were so confident in Porta Subs and Daddy's Chicken that you bought the companies and are, you know, creating a big blueprint across the nation. Why did you gravitate towards food service franchisors versus some other segment? Why did that appeal to you?
It was actually an accident. When I started looking for franchisors to invest in, I was going to stay away from food service. However, We found out about daddies, and it was a great concept, a great young couple that was trying to make it go forward. We thought that that they would be good for it. We could make it work. The other case was Porta Subs, a fabulous regional company, been around 52 years, 135 stores open. And it was a unique opportunity in that both the founder and both of his daughters wanted to retire, and he was in his 70s now. And so we had the opportunity to buy that, keep many of their people, especially one of their senior officers, and then we've adapted them to the regional developer model, to where we sell regions, the regional developer opens one unit, and then sub-franchises, if you will, for the company.
Dave, I want to ask you some broad questions about entrepreneurship, leadership, and sales. And in some of the ways I want to, in some cases I want to ask you, what is your insight from lessons learned? When it comes to your experience as a salesperson, right? You've been selling all of your life. Your book is in many ways both a business manual, and it's also a memoir about experiences, lessons learned. What's your biggest lesson learned around a mistake you made in sales that transformed the way you now choose to treat your vendor, your supplier, your customer? Something that you made a mistake in that you learned to change.
You know, the most amazing mistake was, I was very young. I wasn't even 20 years old yet. I was in the military, and I had started buying and flipping houses as a way to make more money than I could as an airman coming out of basic training. I didn't have any confidence. I had a Volkswagen. I was skinny. I knew anybody looked at me, looked like I was 14 or 15 years old. And I just, that lack of confidence did not work for me. I just couldn't get over the hurdle. As it would happen, I actually quit the company I joined part-time. I'd already paid for a seminar with a motivational speaker. I went to it anyway, and he was smooth. I'd never had training like that. Every break, I ran up, shook his hand, said, "My, this is fabulous." I pestered him to death. He became a mentor to me, but that's another story. That night on my way home, I'm standing in a grocery, or in a grocery line, and a little Hispanic girl was standing in front of me talking to her father. And I said, "Excuse me, are you talking about real estate?" And she said, "Well, yes, we are. My dad has to move to Albuquerque, and he doesn't speak English." And so I encouraged her to let me come home with him. I listed that property, had my first listing. It sold that night. The next morning, she had told me that she and her fiance wanted a house. I took them, showed them a house, and sold it. They referred me to three others. And in 48 hours, I had a listing sold, and I had four sales. And what the heck was the difference from me from, you know, 48 hours before? When I made those sales, they hugged me. The guys bro hugged me. The girls would kiss me on the cheek, and they'd say, "I never dreamed we were going to have a house this young as we are." And all of a sudden, I realized what I was doing was worthwhile. I wasn't adding up the commissions. It's, I'm having an effect on people's lives. And the only difference between me and 4 or 5 days before was I had the confidence that I could look somebody in the eye and say, "Well, I made four sales this week."
Dave, let's talk about entrepreneurship. No doubt you've made some great decisions there, right? As now the co-founder and chairman of one of the most consequential real estate companies in the world, not just in the U.S. What's a mistake that first-time entrepreneurs make that's easily preventable or avoidable, regardless of what industry? Someone is moving out of a corporate job, they're becoming an entrepreneur. What is the most common mistake or two people make?
The common mistake is being naive and too optimistic. Nothing is ever going to cost as little as you think it's going to, and nothing is going to ever move nearly as fast as you think it will. Therefore, the demon that haunts most entrepreneurs is they're undercapitalized, they're uneducated to actually how to run a small business, if you will, and that's two strikes against you before you open your door.
Okay, so the flip side, I don't know someone whether they have a, that doesn't have a dream of either being an entrepreneur or perhaps a side hustle. Not everybody wants to be an entrepreneur, but a lot of people want to supplement their income. They want to turn their passion into a side hustle or some revenue, or they want to pay for their college kids' college education by something on the side. What's some broad sage advice you would give from your 50 plus years as an entrepreneur to say, hey, these are some things you need to be thinking about and ticking and tying as you move that way?
You have to think, what's this business or side hustle going to be? And it better be something you're passionate about. One of the problems with scuba diving and piloting is that everybody wants to be a scuba diver and a scuba instructor. And so you have unlimited number of people vying for a limited number of spots. And so the income is always very low. The same thing with wannabe pilots. It's expensive to get a private license, but if you want to be a professional pilot, you also have to have an instrument, commercial, multi-engine. And so it's very expensive to get there. After you've had 500 hours of training and piloting, hey, there's a huge demand for pilots now. And so if you can get out of the group that's struggling at the bottom, you can become full-time pilot. It's just that it's very difficult getting started in things that a lot of people are passionate about. But there's a lot of things you can start realistically, fairly low income. Let's say you love photography and everybody needs photographers. There's weddings, there's family events, there's whatever. They don't look down on a 20-year-old that's a photographer because they can see the work that you can exhibit to them. And so I'd say find something you're passionate about, you've got a basic knowledge of, and then go all in.
Dave, no doubt you've been approached by people in your years to invest in other people's businesses. Are there questions that you ask individuals that they need to be prepared to answer and like crush before you would ever consider investing in their business?
I think the most important question is, how adaptable are they? What problems have they faced up against that they managed to solve? And what problems have they faced in their life that did not have a successful outcome? Success is repetitious. There's a saying in the military, courage comes from confidence, and confidence comes from experience, and experience comes from training. And so if you're low on the training, and you don't get the confidence, you don't get the experience, you're going to be afraid of what you're doing.
In many ways, your book is a leadership book and isn't just, in any case, for entrepreneurs. By every case, your book should be read by people who are moving up into leadership roles. Share some thoughts with us broadly on the best leaders do what?
Well, I give like 10 principles, but the number one thing that a leader is really good at, must be good at to get followers, is they sell hope. If you look at Martin Luther King, he was selling hope to not just black and brown people, but to white people, that there is a society coming where everybody gets an education, where everybody can live next to anybody they want to, that we can have a better world without the prejudice that we've gone through for hundreds of years. Many people followed that belief. If you look at Ronald Reagan, his campaign slogan was "Make America Great." All Trump did was say, "Make America Great Again." Hillary said, "Stronger with Hillary." I don't think that's hope. But if you look at Obama, it was one word. It was hope. People are selling optimistic hope that they can lead you someplace that's a better place that you want to be.
Dave, you wrote in your book on numerous accounts of other thought leaders that you admired, authors, speakers, entrepreneurs. And as a result of your passion for Napoleon Hill's book, Think and Grow Rich, what I'd heard of but I'd never read, I actually went and bought it in the airport about 3 weeks ago because of your insistence that I read this book. And of course, you wrote in your book that, gosh, you think you've read it 50 times or more. Give a couple of minutes on why everybody listening to this podcast should not just buy The Perfect 10, but should also go out and buy Napoleon Hill's book, Think and Grow Rich.
You know, the book is fascinating. It was written during the Depression. The word rich is put on the title because everybody was broke, and that's what people were buying. I need to get out of this place. In reality, half the book is pretty smart, even 100 years later. The other half is kind of fuddy-duddy, especially the back half. But realistically, what he talks about is goal setting. And in goal setting, he makes the point that, number one, you have to have an achievable goal. And once you've determined what that is, you have to put it into writing, build yourself a blueprint of how you're going to make this happen over a period of time. Get yourself a support group. He calls it a mastermind group that will encourage you, point you down the road in the right direction, tell you when you're making a mistake. And then if you follow that and never give up, you're probably going to do better having big goals and missing a little bit than having very low goals and hitting it.
Let's talk about a chapter in your book around change. You know, has there ever been a time in your or my existence where there is more change facing us, coming at us from every angle? What AI is likely to do to every industry is yet to be seen. Independent of an unprecedented level of change coming to our culture, our governments, the world order, to cryptocurrencies, to the way technology and cyber wars, all of that could be actually quite daunting if you think about it. Independent of the fact that all that change is coming to us for good and for bad. Speaking of principles, are there a couple of principles that you would remind everybody listening right now, that from you, a man of significant personal wealth, you and your wife are remarkable philanthropists, we'll talk about that in a moment. You're a sage, you're a very wise guy, you have a sterling reputation. I've met you on several occasions and found you to be nothing but an absolute gentleman. You're also a savvy business owner, and you're a savvy leader. Remind us of some governing principles that everyone needs to make their core brand while we face unrecognizable change in the world.
Integrity is a very important part of the world. You can ask any lady. There's no such thing as being a little bit pregnant. You're either pregnant or you're not. You're either honest or you're not. Now, white lies have a place. And that if your wife asks you if this dress makes her look heavy, it's a nice thing not to comment on her weight and just say, I think you'd look better in something else. But in reality, integrity and transparency, that people can understand that you're a man of principle, but you're a man that makes mistakes. And I've learned more from my mistakes than I've ever learned from my successes. The second thing I'd say is adaptability. Change is happening so rapidly. Technology is driving so much of it. The knowledge in the world is doubling like every 24 months. We're going places we never even dreamed of going to. And so change is very difficult for many people. Many people just don't want to face it. The truth of the matter is, it's adaptability. You've got to adapt and change. You can't do today's business with yesterday's methods and expect to be in business tomorrow. Those two are pretty simple.
Something I have found fascinating about you is that you keep going. I mean, you have checked the box on everything possible, right? Your family, your business, your legacy, your and your wife's philanthropy. You've come back from enormous, you know, potential setbacks, including, you know, shepherding RE/MAX through this consequential storm. Why did you just write this seminal book? Why are you buying franchise, or why are you becoming, I mean, you're constantly reinventing yourself. You're at the crescendo of life, right? Where most people now are golfing and sailing and relaxing, which I imagine you do some of that yourself. What drives you?
Well, Scott, as a boy, I wanted to be an adventurer. I wanted to fly airplanes, jump out of airplanes, scuba dive. I wanted to hunt, fish, camp, everything you could think of that would be fun. And didn't have much of that in Marion, Indiana. As I started growing up, I started achieving some of those goals. I was the first certified diver in Indiana in 1955 at 10 years of age. I've now got several thousand dives worldwide behind me. As I did all these things, from diving to racing NASCAR, to driving dragsters, to flying airplanes, doing aerobatics in a fighter jet, 12 years ago, I went to the hospital hoping to get a back surgery. I went toxic and in shock in about 2 hours. Went into a coma for 3 months. They discovered that I had MRSA, a type of staph infection that Vietnam vets get at age 65 to 70. And when I woke up, they tried to put me in hospice. My family wouldn't allow it. And I was basically a quadriplegic. And I thought about that, and I was in a lot of pain. And I thought, why not just let it go? And it's done, There's nothing else left, and just go to sleep. And then I thought, you're a hypocrite. You've traveled the world giving seminars for 40-some years about you can do anything you set your mind to. And I perked myself up, and I said, well, maybe I'll be a paraplegic. If I am, I've seen the paraplegics playing basketball and ice hockey and stuff in a wheelchair. They're pretty aggressive. I could still be a manly man. And so all my doctors said, I'm sorry, you're never going to walk again. We've done the nerve tests. They're shot. You're too old to renew. I told them, basically, I don't buy it. I'm going to walk out of this hospital, and you can kiss my bottom. And they didn't like that very much. I worked on my physical therapy, voice therapy. I had to learn to speak. I had a mentality of a six-year-old. By the time they had me out of the coma for 6 months, it was up to high school. I told them, don't get too proud. That's all I've got. And then I walked. And so if my spine had been completely severed, that was impossible. I wouldn't walk. As it was heavily injured. I got time. I got the right medical care. I got the right physical therapist that pushed me harder than anybody in the world. And the end result was I could walk. I tried to play golf a little bit. That hurt. Also hurt the fact that my spine was 4 inches shorter than it was. And so instead of 5'7", I was about 5'4", whatever. My drives were not 200 yards. They were 100 yards. And I said, hey, this isn't very much fun. And I started reallocating my brain and stating, what is it I'm good at that I can still do? Because at age 78, I can't get in a race car and drive 200 miles an hour. So I realized that my biggest thing in my life was I like to accomplish stuff. And more than that, I enjoyed teaching. And so I just decided, okay, you've got a handicap. I can get around in my electric wheelchair when I'm too tired or it's too painful, but I can still walk several thousand steps a day. And so what can I do? And I could mentor people in building a business. I could rebuild another brand like Remax. I could get the thrill of accomplishment, et cetera, and at the same time, help another generation of entrepreneurs find their way. And I owe it to the world because a lot of people helped me along my journey of success. This is my chance to pay it back.
Beautifully said, sir. I think you have inspired lots of people that are struggling with perhaps less daunting challenges than you had to double down and decide what it is that they're great at. At my invitation, would you end our podcast and talk about your legacy? You and your wife are well-known philanthropists. You have some passionate causes that I'd invite you to talk about today so that people can know what part of your legacy is. And then maybe talk about two things. One, what are some of the causes that you and your wife are invested in, literally? And then two, what do you hope will be the impact that The Perfect 10 has on the reader?
Well, in the first place, we were in RE/MAX about 20 years before the numbers got big enough that we could consider ourselves becoming wealthy. And we made a conscious decision at that time that we would give a third of our money to philanthropy, and a third of our money would then go to taxes, and a third of the money would go to us and our family. And that we've stuck with that formula now for well over 50 years, I guess. We built a golf course that was opening in 1977 called Sanctuary, a very difficult terrain, mountainous terrain south of Denver in a place called Castle Pines. It took a year to build, and the architect said, "What are you going to do with it?" And I said, "Well, I haven't decided yet. Would it work if we let it grow in for a year since it's such severe slopes? And then by then I'll have my decision made." He said, "If you can afford it, sure." During that year, dozens of RE/MAX agents came forward and said, "Can we do a golf tournament for our charity?" And that's pretty normal in the philanthropy circles, is golf tournaments is a great way to raise money. And so we decided on an application procedure. September of 76, we put out the word that we would look at 10 or 12. And then we had 300 applied. We took the 300 and we put them into four different stacks of children, of medical, of tragedy, of education. And then we started going through it to see which ones appealed to us. The end result was, up to that point, we'd written a check to the church or to the United Way or whatever on a hit or miss basis. After spending a couple days going through these 300 cases, it was an eye-opener to us that we were insulated from the problems of the rest of the world. We'd been so busy working on our business 18 hours a day, 7 days a week, and by the way, loving every minute of it, that we really weren't attuned to society around us. And that was our eye-opener. That was where it all of a sudden said, look at all these things we should be involved in and using our excess wealth, except for when we were broke, and we squeezed every bit that we could out of every single dime because we couldn't make our own payroll. And so the last thing I wanted to do was find a philanthropic cause that they were paying the CEO $4 or $5 million a year, and maybe the recipients of the money only got 10 cents on the dollar. And so I learned how to measure that, which websites to go to, and which would get the biggest bang for the buck. And once we did that, it started settling into the other part of your question of what are we involved with? We're heavily involved with the police. I've been a reserve officer for many years, a lot of friends in the police. We're heavily involved with Wounded Warriors. We have a scholarship fund at CSU that helps combat vets finish their college degrees. Today's combat vet gets 2 years of VA benefits, whereas in Vietnam era, we got 4 years. And so a lot of people go to 2 years and they drop out because they just don't want to absorb the debt and they start working at something else. We're heavily involved in children's activities. Children's Medical Network is the large charity that RE/MAX has been involved with for over 20 years, and our agents have given personally of their own money, I think $215 million to local children's hospitals. And so the things that are important to us are things that we've experienced ourselves. You know, any man can look at a woman and say, "I understand you just got diagnosed with breast cancer. I certainly know how you feel. That's nonsense. The only person that knows how she feels is another woman that has had breast cancer and perhaps survived it. And so you find that people that have breast cancer, their philanthropy goes towards other people that have a similar problem. You find people that have different causes, it's because something happened to them and they want to support that cause.
Dave, what do you want the reader of The Perfect 10 to take away from their experience with your book?
I hope it makes the entrepreneurial journey an easier journey for them to make. The world needs entrepreneurs. If you look at our country, the United States, you know, about a third of our country revolves around the government. About a third revolves around big business. And the third is the backbone of our business, which is small businesses. And you don't really realize how many hundreds of thousands of small businesses are until you drive down the shopping mall or you go down to a strip mall and you start seeing tax preparation services, hair salons, places to eat, real estate offices. There's just so many small businesses out there, and every one of them has got their dream and they're trying to make it come true. I think there's enough nuggets of good information in this book that even if they get one good idea out of it that helps them save some money or make more money than they thought they could, then the book has accomplished what it was supposed to.
The title is The Perfect 10, 10 Leadership Principles to Achieve True Independence, Extreme Wealth, and Huge Success by Dave Liniger with Laura Morton. Dave, chairman of RE/MAX, co-founder of the organization with your wife, Gail, appreciate the generous time you invested in our podcast today. Thank you for joining us.
Always a pleasure, Scott.
And we'll see you back here next week for a new conversation on leadership.